My name is Kelly Wallace. This is the presentation on Spam, Spim, and Splog. Just a little bit about myself for anybody who wasn't here yesterday. I'm an attorney with Wellborn Wallace and Woodard here in Atlanta. We're a small firm with that really has a specialty in internet law. We do a bunch of general civil litigation and intellectual property stuff. I haven't checked recently, but these things typically show up in the news feeds that I watch. I think I hold the record for the two largest anti-spam judgments in U.S. courts. I have a total of $12 billion in anti-spam judgments. One of those is a little over $1 billion, and another one is 11 point something. I'm not real precise on the numbers because we don't actually expect to recover $11 billion from the defendant that we got the judgment against. The first judgment was actually against three defendants for a total of $1.2 billion, and a little bit of money has been recovered on that. But the other one for 11 is against an individual who promptly fled the United States to his native Haiti. And we think he's still there, and we don't think he had $11 billion to begin with. So we have some experience in anti-spam stuff. We've represented anti-spammers specifically when they've been sued by slimy spammer attorneys for things like defamation and tortious interference. We've also recently started representing folks who are trying to do, you know, legitimate email marketing in compliance with CAN spam and other state and federal regulatory schemes when they get into trouble or get harassed by folks that are a little too over the top in what they think the law allows or doesn't allow. So I asked this yesterday when we talked about botnets. I'll go ahead and ask again to check the level of the room. Does anybody here not know what spam is? And that's actually a trick question, because I have a feeling everybody knows what spam is, and I'll bet that, you know, I'm just going to say there's a dozen people here. I bet we got five different definitions. Anybody want to give me what they think? Well, I have a definition of spam, and I think my definition comports with federal law. So when lawmakers talk about spam, hopefully they're not always the smartest folks. They're not always the sharpest knives in the drawer. But hopefully they're thinking about it the same way that Congress did back in 2004 when CAN spam went into effect. Anybody got a definition they want to try? Yeah.
Unsolicited bulk
messages. Yeah. See, he's using a word that is not actually required, which is bulk. And bulk is not in my definition. You can send one email and it's spam. So yeah, there you go. That's the one. It's
like commercial, though, because look at the number of things that do not appear to have any redeeming commercial value whatsoever. They're not trying to sell anything. It's bogus junk or malicious software that might on the back end have a commercial motive to them, but they're not trying to sell you anything.
Right, but that's, and in my definition, that stuff's bad. That's not spam, though. That's fraud. And that's either fraud or worse. You know, your what are known as your Nigerian emails, you know, I have a large sum of money, give me your bank account number and I'll launder it through there and share it with you. You know, yeah, those get sent out in huge volume, but that's not spam.
That's fraud.
That's bad email. But it's just like, you know, it's the difference between junk mail, which you get in your mailbox every day, you know, from companies that you don't want their product or their service or you don't care, and getting a letter in the mail that says, hey, I've just inherited a large sum of money, give me your bank account, write back with your bank account number and I'll share you. That's fraud. So, and with CAN spam's passage a few years back, commercial email has more or less moved into a very parallel position with what we call junk mail, direct mail, commercial mail. So that's part of what I want to talk about today. So pre 2005, there were it was the Wild West of commercial email. The guy who started the firm that I'm at, Pete Wellborn, was one of the pioneers in that area with a lot of early success against folks who are actually still in the spam business, like Sanford Wallace. Really, you know, kind of had to blaze a trail with some unique legal theories on litigating against spammers, things like trespass to chattels, which is trespass to personal property, or conversion of services, or breach of contract. If you're spamming, if you're sending your mail into an ISP that has a you know, public policy that says even if you're not one of our subscribers, you can't use our mail server in the following way, you know, that's like a no trespassing sign. And as soon as you do it, you are trespassing, and you're also potentially, you are agreeing to those terms of service by using their mail server. And when you fail to live up to those terms, you've breached the terms of your license or your contract. A lot of states passed some anti-spam laws with mixed success. Virginia had a pretty robust one because Virginia is the great state of AOL. Washington has one because Microsoft is there. And then a state that most people wouldn't associate very much with spam, the state that I used to get $12 billion in judgment, which was Iowa. Iowa had a fantastic anti-spam law from my point of view. It had very low thresholds for proof for the ISPs. It had the ability for an ISP or an individual recipient to sue. And I represented an ISP with about 5,000 subscribers. And it also had a $10 per message statutory damages element. So unlike a lot of the early spam cases where AOL had to go up in front of the courts in Virginia, or Earthlink had to go up in front of courts here in Georgia and prove up that they spent money on their abuse department or anti-spam technology or anti-spam filters or how much bandwidth was wasted. And I mean, if you're talking about a company like an Earthlink or an AOL or an MSN, trying to prove damages for wasted bandwidth, I mean, spam's a lot of junk, but you're really talking being able to point back at any one spammer, you're talking really tiny damages on a per message basis. Statutory damages are $10 a message, and then you get the other stuff like the fact that they were generating fraudulent header, they were using fraudulent headers, fraudulent from addresses, and all that. That allows you to trigger things like federal wire fraud statutes, which is a predicate act for the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act, or RICO, which is typically used against organized crime. What RICO does is it doesn't give you any extra damages; it just lets you triple them at the end of the case. So my guy that I got the $11 billion judgment against, we had him locked into about 300,000 messages that we could prove were his. They were spamming his domains, they were spamming his stuff. And so that got me about $3 million, and then RICO kicked in and tripled it. So yeah. State anti-spam laws were pretty good. So Congress came along and they decided that because this is interstate and because the Direct Marketing Association has a big lobby, those are the same people that are responsible for the lobbying group and the professional group for sending you junk mail in your mailbox are the same people that are now bankrolling email reg. They got together and got Congress to pass the CAN-SPAM Act, which we call the ICAN-SPAM Act. But it does some things that are good. It does set some standards that allow legitimate email marketers to operate. And if you're going to live in those standards, I think most reasonable people would say commercial email is okay. That as long as they're sending an email and it's not coming from a spoofed, if everybody knows what spoof means, a faked from address, if it has an opt-out link that they are required to honor within a very short time window, and that once they do that, they cannot send you any more mail ever, ever, ever. They have to use proper subject lines. They can't say pictures from our trip last week and then, you know, pop up a porn site. As long as they're sending, you know, what would be proper professional commercial email, more or less that's, you know, in my opinion, that's okay. They're not trying to trick anybody. They're trying to sell you something. And if you don't want to see it anymore, you can do with them something that's very hard to do with the mail that comes in your mailbox, which is click a link and say, no more. And if they don't honor that, there are serious penalties for that.
So how do you put that on? They can sell the list to other people who then spam you. And that's a different group.
Well, you're right. And that's one of the biggest problems with CAN-SPAM. I don't think CAN-SPAM is perfect. In no way do I think CAN-SPAM is perfect. I think one of the things that really hurts can spam, but I absolutely know why it's there, is that individuals have no claim under can spam. If you're pissed off because you're getting spam, pardon my French, you need to either complain to your ISP or you need to complain to your state attorney general, because those are the people that can actually prosecute, or the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. Those are the folks that can actually file a lawsuit for can spam.
If
you run your own web server, you're probably an ISP. So, or your own mail server. So the problem is, if some, you know, you said, what if you get on a, what if somebody sells your name from a list, sells the list? You're right. That's part of the problem. There is no master registry. You know, there's a do not call list that the FTC maintains, and there was a lot of discussion about starting a do not mail list. That's something that is actually in the Can Spam Act in the legislative findings, that the FTC should, by its regulatory power, pass some regs to allow citizens to register email addresses that sending commercial email to would automatically be a violation. Well, anybody want to guess what the problem, what the fear of having that list would be?
Unscrupulous spammers will take that list,
yeah.
And
right.
By the time I got back,
we're cross-talk.
All right.
Basically, under the assumption that this is a list of emails,
yeah,
that are checked,
right,
and that people don't want.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, can spam. You know, we talked about this with botnets yesterday. The jurisdictional
reach of you on the internet.
The jurisdictional reach of can spam, you know, doesn't stop somebody in Canada from using
it. And I think somebody did our two video.
Something else.
Wireless person.
Can y'all hear me if I just talk loud?
Wireless mic.
Oh, yeah, that's a
good
point.
I watched the
stronger.
All right.
Okay, awesome.
So, yeah, can spam. Basically, you know, it's got some basic ground rules. No false headers. No false routing information. You know, no deceptive or fraudulent subject lines. An opt-out mechanism. And it also requires, which I see a lot of violations of this by folks that are probably really trying to comply. You know, if I get an email from Target, for example, usually that's, I'm going to guess, not something that they wanted to violate can spam. But and I'm not saying Target does this for sure. I just know I've seen it in some big store emails that my wife has received. They're required to give you a postal address, so you could actually write them a letter and tell them to take your email address off of their list, and they're required to honor it within a certain period. It has some aggravated violation triggers, such as mailing out to using a dictionary attack. You know, just I'm going to send out to every 20 character, you know, username at a particular domain. That's a violation. Address harvesting. How you would prove address harvesting from the mailing end is a little bit beyond me. But as long as they meet these technical requirements, it's not actionable. The other thing can spam did is it wiped out all the state anti-spam laws by the doctrine of federal preemption. Now, it has an exception in there, and a lot of states have stepped up and put laws into place of the exception. Georgia did. I know that Pete and I helped the governor's office draft the bill that got passed, the Slam Spam Act, although we strongly advised against that title. Which is fraud and abuse, fraud and deception. If somebody's sending out an email that is in any way fraudulent or deceptive, that's in technical detail, that's in content, subject line, or whatever, the states can still act independently. So a lot of states have either repassed the fraud, specifically the fraud portions of their email, their spam laws, or they've actually put into place new laws specifically to regulate fraudulent email practices.
Well, one of the things that we've noticed, I deal with spam at a university, and one of the things we've noticed is the Can Spam Act actually made it harder to deal with spam. because before you could tell people don't ever respond to a spam email that you get because you can't tell the real ones from the fake ones, and when you click on the link to take yourself off the list, you're actually saying, yes, this is a legitimate email address, continue sending me more spam. And well, as a result, the bad guys now send email that looks like Target or Walmart or whatever that's not, and they do all the legitimate things to make it look like it's in compliance with canned spam. And when you do respond, or if they have a little GIF image in there and it loads, they now know they have a legitimate email address. So it actually helped the spammers get through some of our defenses.
Now, the other angle that spam can be fought at, and legal angle, because the technical angle, I think, since canned spam is really come to the... We've always talked about spam control being a combination of civil enforcement, law enforcement, and technical advancement. That you need good filters, you need good, anti-scam, anti-spam technology in place at your mail server, and you need a good abuse department at your ISP, or you need to be your own good abuse department dealing with this stuff. You need to be out there punishing the folks that are trying to make their money with illegal commercial email. And then you need law enforcement out there trying to deal with the folks that are really going over some serious lines, committing fraud, theft, all those other sorts of things in it. Canned spam, I think, has really pushed to the fore the technical angle, because it did legitimize a lot of emailing. And it really did, I think, bring out some more legitimate emailing than you would have otherwise had today. You have more big companies that feel fine because they know they're within the bounds of the law doing email marketing. Now, what hasn't changed is that I don't know of an ISP that has a policy that says, please send all of our users your advertisement so long as they comply with this federal law. In fact, most ISPs have policies that say you cannot send your commercial advertising messages to my users, period. Yeah.
That's the unsolicited aspect of it. They have to have some prior business relationship with you.
Well, canned spam has that. If you have let me make that clear too. Canned spam, from the beginning, totally takes out of the spam category, the regulated mail category, what's called transactional messages. If you bank with Bank of America and they have your email address, they can send you messages. And it can be about your account or it can be about some new service they'd like you to buy. And you can tell them to stop sending them to you, but they are not required to have the opt-out link. They're not required to even honor it. Why? Well, because if you don't like how Bank of America, your contractual partner in this relationship, is treating your email inbox, you can take your business elsewhere. And then they can't mail you anymore, except for, if you still owe them money or something like that. But transactional messages are outside of canned spam pretty much automatically. And the same, from the marketing point of view, that's sort of the procedure they're trying to take with respect to ISPs that try to totally eradicate commercial email, even legitimate commercial email, is, if you're an ISP, your customers might want to know about the new deal from whatever, from legitimate company, Best Buy, Target, Sears, whoever it is. And if you're filtering all that stuff out, you may lose customers. I can't imagine an ISP that actually has lost customers because they haven't received legitimate commercial email, but I guess it's possible. A more recent trend you see with things like Google's Gmail, especially if you read it on the web and using a web browser, and Yahoo, is those companies want to screen out commercial email because they want to show you their own contextual advertisements with their email messages. And why should they have to compete with things in your inbox when they're already trying to show you things that you might want to buy in the sidebars on your web page? So they have a very different motive for wanting to screen out spam. Let's see.
One would think that they would be at the forefront of the technical side of screening spam.
I have for various, for, you know, personal and work purposes, I have an MSN account at the live domain. I have a Gmail account. I have, through the firm, we still have Bell South email, and we have, a vanity domain for the firm that just forwards to our Bell South domain that's hosted by AT&T. And the difference in the amount of spam that I see on those four accounts is ridiculous. And I mean, I don't, you know, when I have to do an investigation for something where I'm trying to find a domain, you know, I'm trying to look at a website that a client wants shut down or something, you know, I create a brand new address for that every time. So I'm not out there, my wife's working today, so I don't think she's in the audience, but yeah, so whenever I have to go check out a porn site for work, for example, I create a new email address. So, you know, my personal Gmail account isn't going to those sites. That address isn't getting used. My work address actually has been used to do some investigations, so it gets some of that stuff. But the amount of spam I see is actually very light on all of those. That the really gross, you know, and when I say gross, I just mean the really abusive stuff, the pharma ads and all that. That stuff's getting stopped by all those ISPs pretty well. Jamie Woodard at the office, he has used his email, his work email address for all kinds of stuff, and he gets the most ridiculous stuff in his inbox every day. So, to some extent, there's a prudence factor to it. But I think the technical stuff has come along real far. I mean, I'm very impressed with Gmail, for example. I don't think I've ever seen what I would consider a spam, fraud, or phishing email hit my Gmail box. I'm not endorsing Gmail. I'm just saying that out of all the ones I've seen, they've kept their inbox the cleanest. And that's purely anecdotal.
A lot of ability to see messages that are showing up in multiple users' accounts, where the smaller ISP doesn't have as large as a sample base.
Right.
Gmail also can be scanned for
stuff. Really?
Yeah, when mail gets delivered, they'll be scanned later, assuming that the content
filter. Huh, that's awesome. I guess. I mean,
as long as you haven't read the message,
yeah. I guess that's great as long as you don't mind Gmail reading your inbox.
Well, just their computer.
They're scanning it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, that's a concern. You know, that's a concern that we hear about, that I hear about, because lawyers have to go, like doctors and like any professional in Georgia, you have to go to so many hours of continuing education every year, and there is a discussion about should you be using something like Gmail, Yahoo, Hotmail, or that for your professional correspondence, because we have a confidentiality requirement. You know, when a client sends me an email, nobody else should be reading it. And should we be trusting Gmail, for example, which scans it, sure, but also, you know, when I open an email, they're putting up contextual ads that are doing something with the content of that email. Right. And, you know, how close is that getting to the line of am I opening my client's correspondence up to somebody who's not authorized to see it? Yeah.
Well, that's one of the issues we have, is we've talked about outsourcing email, or what happens when a professor decides to use Gmail as an example, and a student sends grade information. Well, that's FERPA data. That's federally protected data. Well, we don't have a contractual agreement with Gmail or with Google to prevent disclosure. We haven't done a non-disclosure agreement or anything with them. So as a result, we're essentially delegating to them the protection of that data. And if they happen to release it, one of their workers puts it up on the internet and it gets released, we're actually held liable for that and not them. So that's one of the dangers fall into.
So let me see. Let me get done with mail. We'll move on and we can... I'll open up to questions. Other things that we've talked about, that we've briefly touched on, that really aren't spam, that are really just fraud and fall in other categories. Phishing, everybody knows what phishing is, right? Malware, and other sorts of bad packages associated with email. Why is spam still being used, even non-legitimate, you know, non-canned spam, compliant spam? Is because it works. It's cheap. It's easy, and they may get a tiny, tiny fraction of actual conversions, you know, sales out of a mail blast, but that costs less than what it costs them to send it, and that's the business. However, I do think that the technical advancements in shutting it down is really starting to transition the marketing among your dirty marketing programs away from email. It's not as effective as some of the other things, such as I'm blanking on it. Social networking website spamming, Facebook, MySpace, Tagged.com. Although Tagged.com got sued by the New York State Attorney General for spamming themselves recently, where folks go on and they send these internal messages. There actually has been a case in out of California very recently. I like the idea, but I disagree with how the court got to the end, which is they have applied the CAN Spam Act to a defendant who was sending messages within MySpace. They had created MySpace accounts, and they had sent personal messages to other MySpace people advertising something, and the Northern District of California said, oh yeah, that's CAN Spam, that's email. And I really think that once you get into a situation where everybody's inside the same playground, such as a social networking website, that's really not email. Oh, they've certainly done some wrong. They've certainly done things that should get them sued up and down the street, like breach of contract and tortious interference and that. But I don't think CAN Spam should kick out of that.
It has a from address, it has a to address, it has a date. How is it not email? It has a message. It has content of a message. It has a header, from to date. It can be responded.
Right. Well, and that's how the court got to that. Well, saying it's not SMTP was the defendant's argument, and the court's argument was exactly that. It has a from address. It has a to address. It has a subject line. It's email. And the definition of email in CAN Spam doesn't include, for good reason, any technical details. When they say headers, they don't talk about what headers are, because Congress knows we're going to pass this law in 2005. We don't want it to be obsolete in 2006. So if we say SMTP and then some genius comes along with a better way to send mail and everybody switches to it, well, then your law is toast, is dead. So.
The problem with defining anything with a to, from, and content as email is then at that point everything is email. IMs are email. Facebook messages are email.
Text messages
are email, and
SMS.
Everything becomes email, and now you're starting to, like you said, you're applying this law. It starts turning into a SOX situation where you don't know what's going on. So now you have unnamed auditors trying to sell you their service to tell you, oh, here's how you're CAN Spam compliant, here's how you avoid that law. And having to deal with an overly broad law like SOX, that way lies madness, sheer utter madness on the technical side. If you apply it overly broadly, you could probably successfully sue almost any ISP for violating that act, because every bit of traffic going through their router you could almost, outside of just generic web pages, you could almost classify it all as email.
Right. And I agree. I mean, I think CAN Spam is, again, it's not a perfect law. I think it did do something that needed to be done, which is set some rules, set some standards that I think all the standards CAN Spam sets, I find acceptable. Now, I think that, you know, again, any ISP that wants to block stuff at the gate, go for it. You're not breaking anybody's law. You're not violating any First Amendment rights. Nobody has any First Amendment rights to send email into your mail server. So you can keep the stuff out all you want. But as long as the people that are sending it are not committing fraud or committing crimes, they can try, and if your recipients get it and don't like it, they can say, don't send it anymore. And as long as they do that, everything's fine. And I'm okay with that. But I think that we do, you know, and as we'll talk about, there is a problem with folks doing instant message spamming. I think that needs to be addressed. I think, again, you know, the feds have already stepped in and done CAN Spam. They could step in and do something to deal with instant message spamming. They could deal with text message spamming. I mean, we've got, you know, our firm still gets 10 junk faxes a week. I mean, we have 3 attorneys. We get 10 junk faxes a week. We'd all be on vacation if we bought all the vacation packages. Yeah.
If
Well, from my point of view, canned spam isn't really... The point of canned spam is to make people legitimate. The bad guys are going to do what the bad guys are going to do. So how is an instant messaging equivalent going to stop the bad guys from doing what they're going to do? Is that just ammunition for the cops to string them up and hang them?
Well, and this is a good point. This is a good transition point, because I'll tell you the best thing that canned spam did from the point of a civil litigator. And the best thing that canned spam did, and this is what could be done in the instant messaging context, is canned spam expressly made the advertiser potentially liable. So not just the person that pushed send, not just the person that hired the person to push send, but the person whose product or service is advertised in the message. That person has some liability under canned spam now, and they have liability for no matter what the bad guy downstream from them did. So if that person sent it with using fraud and deception, those aggravating triggers kick in against the advertiser. So, yeah.
Well, that's good for people that are in the U.S. and legitimate businesses and whatnot, but what about all these web... I get bots on Instant Messenger. Hey, you know, like three lines in, I'm like, okay, you sound like a bot. You want me to go to your webcam site? Or, you know, there's the webcams, there's the people in Nigeria. There's lots of people outside of the jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And is that...
That's it right there. It's outside the jurisdiction. And that's going to be something that no law is going to be able to deal with. That's where the technical requirements are going to come in. And in talking about SPIM, you know, something to keep in mind is there's no real public email. I mean, except for things, you know, university email systems are owned by state university systems are owned by the public of that state for the most part. But they're still not public. They're not anybody can wander in and get an email account. Same thing with instant messaging. Most instant messaging, you know, if you're on a big service, if you're using AIM or MSN or ICQ or whatever, those are all private servers. You know, they have a right by contract to regulate exactly what goes on their servers, and they absolutely have every last resource, technical resource at their disposal to ban whatever traffic they can. And as you said, you know, if it's somebody who's sending out bots from South Korea, North Korea, Nigeria, wherever these things really are, law isn't going to help there. It's going to have to come from the technical side.
Now, if anybody can come here, we can bust.
Sure. And, you know, what I think you find is, you know, when we do anti-spam, the stuff that's getting sold isn't being sold from South Korea, if it's a real thing. You know, the people who run porn sites aren't often outside of the United States. The people who sell, who do the transactions when you buy pharma on spam, are typically not outside the United States. My investigator that I talked about yesterday is actually here today. I told him he should come in so we could all point at him when I tell you, you know, he's bought thousands of porn website accounts for me as my investigator, which he told me this morning, I need to tell y'all, is incredibly depressing, because his job would be to get up at 8 in the morning, because some of the payment processors only, I guess maybe for health safety, I don't know, only let you sign up for 20 porn sites a day with the same credit card. So like, we were, you know, on this one case, we were getting literally like hundreds of mail messages a day with dozens upon dozens of different porn sites of all different flavors. And so I would just send him these lists. Go get a subscription to this one. Go get it. You follow, you know, here's the link with the affiliate identifier. Follow this link, buy the subscription, do this. And we quickly ran into the problem that I cannot buy any more today. It will not let me. Like, oh, well, we'll get up tomorrow morning and buy another 20 porn sites. And he actually had to cut out a thing for his, because most of the payment processor, it would take you to the same payment processor screen, so he would cut out a piece of paper and have it over his screen so he didn't have to look at the little graphics for Transsexual Palace or whatever it was that he was buying that really disturbed him. Yeah, it was... I mean,
can he turn off images and just work on the?
I think that was more work that he was willing to do, but it's you know, those payment processors are in the United States. Because Visa isn't going to sign a lot of contracts with folks in, you know, Nigeria. Visa's not going to process credit cards for people in Nigeria. The credit card processing is being done in the United States. Now, sometimes that money's leaving the United States. But you know what? If you're a motivated ISP that really wants to, or you're somebody who really wants to shut down porn spam, and you want to pay me by the hour to do it, I'm happy to sue them. I'm happy to go ahead and let them get them named. They're not going to show up. These folks that get their bank money sent to Ukraine or Liechtenstein or wherever we watch some of these accounts go, they're not going to show up. We're going to get a default judgment, and I'm going to go to CC Bill or who's the other big one? CC Bill was the one that was doing most of the ones in that case, which is in Arizona, and I'm going to hit them with a garnishment. And anytime anybody buys a porn account through CC Bill for that defendant, they keep the money and they have to pay it to my client. You can cut off their money, and that's the best way to deal with these folks. If you can't put them in jail, you got to make it not profitable for them. And catching their money wherever you can within the borders of the United States is how you do it.
I work for a marketing advertising kind of company. I want to say that thing you talked about where the advertisers are responsible, that did because we would get in these arguments because we discovered clients are crazy. They want to send out emails to every person on the globe 10 times a day, regardless of how technically impossible that is. And they think, you know, magically money will flow in because they've read the articles, you know, a small percentage, but you still get money. And so being able to say, by the way, not only will, you know, our ISP Embark get sued, not only will we get sued, but you're going to be there next to us in court because they're going to sue you too. All of a sudden, oh, well, let's not do that. Let's play by the rules. They're a lot less willing to bend the rules when they're going to be sticking their hand in their pocket.
Right. Well, and what you saw in the 90s and the early 2000s was you saw people saying, oh, well, I don't need a marketing company to do my internet marketing. I can get a website, I can send out email, and I can be, you know, and they would do this. They would send out these blasts. They would send out, this is when junk fax got big. And then they found out they could be punished for it. And you really do need, and this is what I say, you really do, email marketing is okay. If it's done legally, if it's done ethically, it should be fine. But you really want marketing professionals involved in there, people that know how to do it correctly, that know what the regulations are, that know what the requirements are. And I think if that were the case, all that we'd be left with, I think you would see attitude shift and you would see people start to differentiate spam, what we really think of as spam, from the other stuff that people include, like fraud, phishing, you know, malware, injection, all that kind of stuff.
So, I'm trying to remember the term used. I think it's JoJo. It's where an adversary will spam a product of a innocent third party with the intention of getting them sued or somehow hurt.
Yeah, that's called a Joe job, if you didn't hear him. I've honestly never seen a real Joe job. I mean, it's happened. It's happened. Don't get me wrong. They happen. You get them all the time. You get them.
At George Tech, we get them constantly where somebody will send out a huge spamming with the return address as cert at CC.
Right, okay.
And so the next thing I know, my administrative inbox fills up with all these hate mail from all these people, stop sending me spam. And the next thing I know, they're coming after me, and I have to explain to them, no, that's a Joe job, and send them a link from Wikipedia. It's not me. We didn't do it.
Yeah, I think we have different... Yeah.
Right. Joe Job is Kmart sending target advertising to people who never wanted them to discredit Target.
In our case, they're actually sending things out in some of the cases we have, specifically so that we get all the things.
Right.
Specific.
Yeah. I guess in our, when we say Joe Job in our office, we're talking about the yeah. You know,
so
you're...
We get those too.
Yeah.
They deliver.
What's Georgia Tech advertising?
Oh,
I know I get spam from tech.
They just got an extra grind with us because we, you know, took them out or cut their network access off or whatever, you know. They just have an extra grind.
The Alumni Association doesn't honor my take me off your list links, by the way.
Normal
behavior.
They did paper stuff.
They are actually independent of, even though they say Georgia Tech, they're not really Georgia Tech. So I do know the admin, so if you get with me, I can contact him and maybe do something.
That's okay.
Also, one thing I'd like to say, because we do a lot of work with Facebook advertising, the amount, the granularity that you can target people with on Facebook once you actually, and you can find this isn't hidden, if you just go look in their advertise on Facebook section, the amount of granularity there is on one level frightening. Some of our clients are hotels and they do, you know, honeymoon packages, weekend packages, and we literally were able to target everybody within a 75-mile radius of this one particular hotel who were in a specific age category, I think like 25 to 35, whose status had recently changed either to in a relationship or to engage or something like that. And I just really like plucking people out. And I will say that, you know, normally if you get 1 or 2%, that's a huge return. This was up around 15%.
Yeah.
So the social networking sites like that, I think you get some spam there, but you're going to see more advertising there because the amount of, you know, they can really tell you things that you actually might want to hear, and the return on the investment is monstrous.
And again, you know, you're doing something that's legitimate. You're, you know, people who sign up for Facebook, you're entering into a contract with, I don't know who, is Facebook run by Facebook? I don't know what the name of the company that owns them is. I know Rupert Murdoch, News Corp owns MySpace, you know, you're entering into a contract with them. They're providing a service to you. You're agreeing that they can sell advertising to you.
Don't put in the data.
Right.
You don't have to put in that level of detail.
You cannot give them your demographics.
Right.
You know, even so, you may fall in, you know, somebody may buy the, I want to show, you know, all Facebook users. I don't know if they sell that one or not. They probably don't.
Yeah, you can buy across the network or specifically.
Yeah.
You cross the network ones are hideously expensive.
Right.
The return kind of sucks because people ignore them. But the targeted ones.
Right. I mean, it's just, you know, whether it's a social networking site or it's email or even if it's instant messaging. I mean, instant messaging in many ways is almost like the radio of the internet. You know, it's not inconceivable to me that you could start seeing. Well, you already do. If you use the clients that AIM or MSN provides, you can be shown contextual advertising in the frame of that thing while you're using it. You know, they have a reason to cut down on third-party advertising in that. And again, it's the same reason that Gmail and Yahoo and Facebook does, which is they don't want the competition. They don't want unauthorized advertising that they're not getting paid for. Let's see.
Is there a backlash that occurs, though? I know people would say, if you advertise to me with a spam message, they classify email as spam. They don't care about Canned Spam Act. If you advertise to me in spam, I will not buy your product. You'd be the cure for cancer, and I'm dying of cancer. I'm not buying it. You know, they are really, really livid about it.
Is very little of that for two reasons. One, the Facebook ads are not blasted across your entire screen. They're off in a corner. Facebook has a really good feedback mechanism for individual users. Hey, I didn't like this ad. Don't show me that, you know, this was, I thought, inappropriate, that kind of thing. I think Facebook has worked around a lot of their problems by making them fairly unobtrusive and giving the individual user really good feedback, whereas with email, you're kind of stuck.
Right.
You know, it shows up or it doesn't.
They give them thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Okay.
And if you use, I know I use Firefox, I have a plugin that blocks all those ads on just about every site I look at. I will occasionally get a client calling me about some sort of, you know, like I had a new client call about some trademark infringement on a Google AdSense ad. And I kept running the search in Google and kept saying, I don't see it. Oh, wait, I forgot. I've turned off all those ads. Hold on, let me see. Oh, there it is. Okay.
What is it you're using to do that?
Probably. It's got a big stop sign on my toolbar.
Adblock,
I think it's Adblock
Plus.
That sounds right.
Okay.
Yeah. Back to email real briefly. There's some other types of email which actually can be legitimate email marketing and still be illegal that I've had some experience with and that will occasionally crop up in the news. One of them is violating crossing the SEC, which When I my first job in law school, I was a law clerk for a judge up in Cherokee County, and he taught me the number one rule to live your life by, especially in the law. There are two groups you never cross, and those are the Internal Revenue Service and the Mafia, and in that order. So, and I have a corollary, and the third one is the Securities and Exchange Commission, because they can do things to you that would, oh my God. So there are lots of, you know, another type of fraudulent email is, which people have heard of, is the pump and dump stock email, where, hey, here's the hot stock tip. It's a penny stock, which means it's unregulated stock, and it's going to be exploding, and people go and buy it. You know, stupid people get the email and go buy it and drive the price up, and then the person who sent the email who owned a bunch of it sells it at, you know, it went from 1 cent to 5 cents a share, and they sell it, and they quintuple their money. That's ordinary. Everybody expects that. The other one, though, is there are things that have been sold via email. Now, this is the one I have experience with was pre-canned spam. This is actually a defendant from the first billion-dollar judgment, and it's the one that we've recovered the most money from. Thank you, SEC, for seizing this company's assets shortly after I got a judgment against them. And that is when they sell things that can validly be classified as securities, because who in this room knows what a security is? And I'm not raising my hand because I'm not a securities attorney. But basically, if you're buying something that is just an interest in a thing, you're not buying the thing. What you've bought is a security. Okay?
A timeshare
is real property. You're buying an undivided share in a piece of real property. It's not a security. But the defendant in my CIS case was a company called CashLink Systems out of Florida. And what they sold was you could buy they put ATMs into convenience stores. Everybody's seen these unbranded ATMs, right? You could be the owner of the revenue from an ATM. So they put the ATM in. They had the service that went and restocked it with cash. And it wasn't, well, actually, I take it back. These ATMs didn't pay cash. I don't know if anybody, I've used one of these in the past. I don't know if it was one of these defendants' ATMs or not. You go, you run your card, it gives you a receipt, which you take to the cashier who gives you the cash. Okay? So the ATMs didn't, they had to be stocked with paper, basically. They had to be hooked up to the internet or a phone line or something to be able to process the card transactions. So you would pay for an ATM, you would get it put somewhere, and then you would collect the revenue that was generated, some percentage of what was, because there's a $5 fee or whatever to use it. That's a security. You don't own the ATM. You don't own the contract with the store that the ATM is. You don't own any of that. You just own the revenue stream. It's a security. And they also hired some spammers to market it. So that's how we got to them. We got like a $700 million judgment against them as part of that first $1 billion. And shortly after that judgment kicked in, the SEC, due to complaints from investors, seized all of the assets of CashLink Systems and stuck it with a receiver in Texas. And so all we had to do was walk up to the receiver in Texas and go, hello, we'd like our $700 million of whatever you've got. And they really didn't want to give it to us because they really wanted to pay these investors that had been defrauded. And we said, well, that's fine. How much did they pay? And altogether, they paid about $250,000 in investment money. I said, okay, we'll take our pro rata share, so 99.999 some odd percent of whatever's left. And they said, well, you're going to have to fight us in court. I said, okay, well, you can take – all you've got is the money, so – Give us a number. How much are you willing to pay us to not have to fight this in court? So they paid us, and we got tens of thousands of dollars out of that, which is good. My client recovered every last dime he paid in expenses for the suit at that point, and then some. So just from that one defendant, and now he can sit back and try and hope that Mr. If you know James McCalla, formerly of Miami, Florida, there's my client's probably happy to pay a bounty if he has any money when we find him. We don't want him dead. We don't want him harmed. We just want him held by the ankles and shaken until all the money comes out of his pockets.
You want him in a position where he can pay.
That's right.
Money.
He needs his check right hand. If he's working somewhere, we want to know who's writing him paychecks. So, I've been on NPR a couple times, and they actually didn't put the part on the radio where I said, I don't care if, you know, he works at McDonald's and has to pay his kids with his employee discount food. I will take the chicken McNuggets out of his child's hand for what this man has done. So, well, you know, there are some spammers I feel some sympathy for because they're not the smartest people. They're not the most educated people. They didn't know what they didn't really think about what they were doing. And but Mr. McCalla, no. And unlike a lot of the judgments we've received in spam cases, I know Pete has a $25 million judgment against Sanford Wallace. We have, you know, millions of dollars of judgment on behalf of Earthlink. Most of those are default judgments. But the spammer gets identified, gets sued, served, and doesn't show up. The $1 billion judgment was a default judgment. Nobody showed up. James McCalla showed up. He responded to the complaint in Iowa. He never showed up in court. The judge lets me appear by phone from Atlanta in Iowa, in the Quad Cities. He let Mr. McCalla appear by phone. And Mr. McCalla, that case went all the way to summary judgment. So that is a real, honest-to-God judgment that, as long as my client keeps registering it with Florida, will last until as long as Mr. McCalla lasts, it will survive. And he has no real good... He's, pardon?
Is it really him, or did he have a corporation?
No, it's really him. He claimed he had a corporation, but he never registered one, and he was sued individually. So, I knew he was going to be a fun ride in that case when I was starting the investigation, and there were a bunch of email or a bunch of domain names he was spamming, and they were all registered. They all had these Haitian address registrations. And so I subpoenaed whatever registrar it was, and they had all been registered using the same credit card. The credit card had valid address and name information for him in Miami. And so I subpoenaed the bank to get his address and all that stuff. And I got a call from his attorney, because the bank takes the subpoena, notifies the client and you know, their customer, and the customer went to his attorney. And she actually would not tell me what his real name was, and put me on the phone with him on a conference call where he admitted that he owned those domain names, he had sent the spam, it wasn't illegal, and that I would never catch him. So, and we haven't caught him, so I guess he's right on that grounds, but I do have the next $11 billion that he earns. So, well, I don't. I only have a third of it. My client gets the other two-thirds of it. I mean, I did not, you know, my driver and my limo did not drop me off here today, so I don't have any of his money yet. So let's spam, instant message spam, you know, more or less the same purposes that email spam is used for. You know, honestly, I'm not a businessman. My professional opinion, I think spam is a lot more manageable because the IM companies really do. They are already the gatekeepers for access to their own messaging services. So, and if you run your own instant messaging server, that you are your own gatekeeper. You are not relying on AOL, MSN, or whoever to screen your email for you. You can, you know, user account, password protect, all that kind of stuff, your own server, or you're going to rely on one of these services to do it. These services are typically free. I mean, is there a paid IM service that is widely used out there that I don't know about?
World of Warcraft.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And actually, that's on my list. But what do you notice with WoW though? I mean, I was a WoW junkie for a while, and I had a client that got me into it, and then got me to join like 7 different guilds and then quit. And Jamie Woodard was, and he continues to relapse into WoW. Gold spamming in WoW was awful for a while, and it was all the trial account users. They'd sign up for trial accounts, spam, 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 get shut down, get a new trial account, spam, spam, spam. So what'd they do? Okay, well, if you're a trial account, you can't use channels. Okay, and then that didn't work because they were sending tells. Okay, if you're a trial account, you can't send a tell to anybody who you're not on their friends list. Okay, well, that really cut it down. So then what happened? They stand in front of the auction house somewhere, and they yell spam or say spam. And then it really just comes down to, at some point, you know, their abuse department has to be on the ball and just kicking these people off as they go along. And why were they? Why was Blizzard so proactive about it? Because they rely on their customers paying every month to continue to use WoW. They have a financial incentive to keep that stuff under control. You know, MSN, AIM, all that, they don't have exactly the same financial incentive. So, but they certainly probably get more complaints. On a technical aspect, I mean, again, I'm not a super technical person, but I've read there's some luck in having some of these services use what's called a human test before you let somebody connect. You know, how do you spell the number and then write out, you know, use the numeral 5. And if the thing that's trying to connect to your chat net can't do it, it's probably a bot and you wave bye-bye to it. Yeah.
One of the big problems with those is optical character recognition.
Yeah.
Really good. Which is why, like, a lot of the image stuff.
Right.
Getting so incredibly hard to read even for people.
Yeah. I've had problems lately where it'll take me five tries before I...
Yeah,
they distort it so much it takes a human 5 tries.
Yeah, exactly. The thing I noticed, at least on blogs, that worked, because I tried a lot of it and people are complaining about the same thing. I can't post a comment because I can't read the friggin' thing. What ended up cutting it literally like overnight from, I was getting 1,000 spam comments a day easily, to zero, was I instituted a registration system. I don't care what email address anyone puts in, but they have to put in something there. And for some reason, the comment spammers have yet to figure out a way around that. So, and recently I signed up with Discus because they do the same thing and a couple other features. But the day that I implemented registration for comments, like I could, within minutes, the spam fallout just dropped.
Yep.
And it was absolutely brilliant. And
do you do one step registration where all they have to do is sign up, or does it send them an email that they have to click a link, or
I forget how Discus did it when I was doing it through movable types built in stuff. It was like here go.
Because we have a client.
The link click stuff I hate, but sometimes depending on the service you can't get around that. What Discus lets you use, like Facebook, Open Auth, a bunch of different stuff.
We have a client that got a story about them in the AJC on the website, the Atlanta Journal Constitution, for those of you who aren't local. And then in the you can do the blog style comments to the online articles. And somebody had put a extremely false defamatory comment about the company. And wanted, you know, us to check to see, you know, what can we do? You know, can we, you know, obviously we can write the AJC and say, hey, zap that, please. They're under no real requirement to, so that's why you say please. But can we find out who that is? Is it possible that we could send a subpoena to the AJC and find out who posted it? So I found a different article on the AJC, and I tried to post a comment, and it made me register. And I said, okay, let's see if it really makes me register. So I made up a fake email address and domain, and I posted it, which is probably, you know, fraud or something like that, in the course of my business day. And it let me post my comment, and I never got a problem with it. And then I tried again using my actual work email address, and it let me post, and it never sent me a, you know, thank you for posting on AJC, or click here to activate your link, you know, or whatever. So yeah, I mean, it sounds like just having that step might dissuade, you know, the bots at least.
It was like the spam level.
One technique I've used on the technical side is something called randomized field names, where I actually use SHA-1 to generate field names based on the time. And what it does is, when you have a multi-form field and you're doing strict validation, the bots are unable to figure out which field they're supposed to fill in for what, because they're all 40 character hashes, and if they guess wrong at all, your validation tosses the post.
There's a special case that we've mentioned once here, which is phone spam, text message spam, or SMS spam that people are getting on their phones. And some states have already passed some laws regulating it. There's some law making its way through Congress to regulate text message spam. And I think that you will probably see, you know, I have received very few of these personally. My wife has gotten a ton of these. My mother gets a ton of these. I don't know how they get them, and I don't. But you got a couple competing factors here. One is you've got what I call my mom factor. My mom has no idea how to even send a text message. So everybody's, almost everybody's phone these days gets them, can get them. So you're going to get a bunch of non-technical people getting these messages. And if you're somebody like my mom, well, I pay for her cell phone, so she has text messaging enabled. But if you don't have it enabled, you're going to get a charge on your bill for getting text messages if you get them, you know, depending on what your plan is. So you're going to have consumers calling phone companies complaining about additional charges on their bill, and then the phone companies are going to do something about it. We've actually represented a client that was sued by the state of Illinois, by the Attorney General, for text message spamming. They were trying to assert CAN spam. Again, you know, another attempt to shoehorn this thing in. And our client really wasn't doing it, so that turned out well.
Yeah. Just real fast, the phone companies are actually starting to invest heavily in anti-spam software. In addition, I think the law that you're talking about, one of the things that it will enable is a spam report as spam button on every phone as a mandate.
Huh. That'll be interesting to see how they can do. I mean, obviously there'll have to be some lag while the technology or the phone's OS or whatever catches up with the law. But you know, the thing is that even without a specific law, text message spamming is still going to run afoul of you know, a half dozen different regular old, not instant message related laws like conversion, trespass to chattels, breach of contracts, tortious interference, unjust enrichment, false designation of origin. I mean, if somebody really wants to sue a text message spammer, there's absolutely nothing to stop, you know, them from being sued under regular law today. And then Splog. Now, I know you talked about getting tons of blog posts, and there's two different competing definitions of Splog, and that's the one that I was familiar with before I did any reading in the last couple of weeks, which is blog spamming, you know, where you're just posting comments, usually advertising this or that or whatever. The other one, which I think is a lot more interesting, involves clever use of framing. If you write a very important article about some subject that's kind of popular, I can put up a website, frame your article into it, and then search optimize my site so that I pop up well enough on engines, and then surround it with advertising that I get the click-through revenue for. So it's kind of like spammers meet copyright infringement. It's, I'm using your work and I'm getting paid for the presentations of it, and you're not. So because I'm just channeling stuff, content through from your site. Yeah.
So that's kind of like if you're a really big famous band, I buy a ticket to go to your concert and set up a table and sell T-shirts for the band, but it's me getting the money, not you.
Yeah, sort of. That's not copyright infringement. That's a different tort that most states recognize. That's right of publicity or right of there's a marketing right usually associated with you. It's probably a trademark thing, but yeah, it's very similar to that. So. You know, much like instant message spam, blog spamming of the kind you're talking about, where people are posting comments onto an article, you know, this is, you know, I put that in the same category as social networking spam. You know, you're on the same playground, you're just not following the rules. There's lots of breach of contract, lots of AUP violation usually with whoever the blog's host is. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the ones we had a lot of is we have researchers develop new types of wikis, all that sort of thing, and they're at a university, so they say, well, we're all friends here. Why do we need security? Let anybody post. Well, that created a problem because the bots got a hold of it, and what they would do is the one that was most egregious is this really graphic porn site. They went to a church's webpage and blogged at the bottom of all these church web pages. And at the bottom of the blog, they make a comment, say, we love your article, that's really good. Come check out our website. And what that does is it gets their link referenced everywhere. So when you go search their kind of porn, they pop up at the top of the Google hit list. So that's how they get their ranking up there. Unfortunately, it actually pointed back to the actual content was a referral off our website at Georgia Tech. So all of a sudden the churches started sending us stuff saying, why are you hosting porn at Georgia Tech, and why are you using our blog sites to advertise it? Please stop that. And the problem is, once you have a couple hundred thousand pages of third-party solicited web pages, it's virtually impossible, short of actually physically viewing every one. There's no tool for figuring out which ones are actually spammed and which ones are real. And so we have to wait till somebody complains and we take the site down.
Yeah.
The other issue, this is one I'm friends with the guy who runs the ISP I use, and is that, especially because most of them are coming like out of Russia, the comments, when I'd actually go tracing them back, IP searches and all that, even assuming that the IPs were vaguely legitimate, they're coming out of like Russia, some China, is that it actually costs you money at that point, because now your bandwidth charges go up, your disk usage, your server resource usage. I got, unfortunately, I don't know if you call it slash dotted, I got Daring Fireballed, which is about the same effect, and they actually had to shut down my comment CGI because the spam bots were hitting it so fast. Even though they'd fail at the registration part, they were still running the CGI over and over and over and over and over. And I watched this friend of mine was sending me like the CPU usage charts, the data usage charts, and just was da-da-da.
Yeah,
and the whole server, which hosts a bunch of other websites, was almost falling over. And that's one of the reasons they ended up going to Discus, because then that comment stuff is off their server.
And you saying the stuff coming out of Russia. I mean, I know I see a lot of when we see stupid spammers who, thankfully, I like stupid spammers more than smart spammers, because smart spammers use things like botnets, and you're never gonna find where they're originating from. So much stuff coming out of Korea, coming out of China, Russia, Dutch IP, the ripe registered IP addresses, and that. Pete talks about this a lot, and I used to laugh and say, no, the internet is great because it's everywhere, but there may really be a call at some point for an ISP or something in this country that just totally firewalls off all non-North American IP addresses from its customers.
They tried that, and a very large phone company that starts with a V got sued very heartily for that.
By who?
I honestly don't know who brought the suit, but they accidentally walled off all of China.
Well, I mean, who sued? You don't know who sued?
No, I don't remember the actual suit, but they were taken to court over.
If I open Kelly's ISP and I say, look, a lot of bad stuff comes from overseas. I'm walling off anything that comes from, north of the Rio Grande, from south of the Rio Grande, ocean.
Even more than the lawsuit, the PR nightmare of them walling off all of China and blocking everything was pretty bad.
But if that's my pitch to my clients, to my customers, and they say, yeah, and they sign up, well, they're not going to sue me for walling off China.
But if they already had signed up and then you decided.
Right, yeah, that's the peril. That's what I'm saying is offer the service of doing it. Don't impose it.
Right.
I think there might be, if all you're doing is sending your email to you're sending out your family newsletter to your grandkids and that, unless one of them takes a job somewhere over there and even then, all they'd have to be able to do is really read their email on a U.S., mail server somewhere.
We've got quite a few associates that basically they blocked up every domain ending in .ru and their spam dropped by something like 75% overnight.
We got somebody script injected the firm's website last month with several times with a .ru trying to force something that looked like a PDF onto folks. I mean, I know people who are yesterday here know I'm the firm's IT department. So I got a call Saturday morning from Pete. Why is Google listing us as a dangerous website? I don't know. Let me see. So I like Firefox. I like the option not just to show source, but to show me all the content, where I can go through and it'll show me the source for every graphic and other file on the website. I'm like, PDF? We don't have any PDFs on our website, and we certainly don't have anything at r43.ru. So so that was cleaned up very quickly.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment because I hear a lot of people with a lot of different thoughts and all. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the organizations that are out there on the internet that actually work on trying to develop best practices and stuff. If you're a sender, there's the ESPC. If you're a receiver, MOG The Messaging Anti-Abuse Work Group is a very active organization. There's also the APWG, the Anti-Phishing Work Group, which I think they're actually meeting real soon. So just thought I'd throw out a couple industry names that are very active in trying to come up with working with law enforcement, as well as sharing best practices on both sides, sender and receiver.
From our point of view, one of the things that we started doing is the, because we don't send it out ourselves. We work with a couple of different companies. If you want to do it, if the company's charging what seems like ridiculously low rate, be very scared. The companies we work with are bonded. They've got, you know, their SLAs with us are very clear. They are very clear as to what they do with their mailing list, the times for processing, the opt-out, things like that. If you want to do it, spend the money per 1,000 messages. It's really not that expensive, but it will keep you off a lot of the hate lists. It'll keep you out of trouble with the various anti-spam groups. And it'll over time, it'll end up paying for itself in the terms of when people don't want you to send you email and they click on the stop sending the email link and the email actually stops.
Right.
That actually generates a lot of customer goodwill, we found.
I have a client that went cheap and he's in court now. You know, when you pay your internet marketing guy $150 over 3 months, and you know, his return on investment was real good. But not once you start taking my legal fees out of it. So, how long are we here for? Or is this? That's fine. Yeah, I just looked at the clock and saw. Anybody have any other questions, comments, anything? Yeah.
I'm a lawyer.
I'm a lawyer. I'm the firm's IT department. But I have 2 degrees from Georgia Tech, but neither of them from the College of Computing. So. Anybody else? All right. Okay. If anybody wants a card, anybody gets sued for sending spam or wants to send spam or wants to pay me to sue a spammer, I'm happy to take your business in a retainer.